Welcome to episode 80 of Bite-Sized Blessings. And yes, once again, I'm in a hotel, traveling across the U.S. to Portland, Oregon. Right now, I'm in Omaha, Nebraska. I'm on the third floor of the Hampton Inn, and I'm using my time this evening to finish the podcast for this week. This week's interview is a little different. I get to interview my friend Chase Stafford, who, in addition to being a very accomplished coffee barista, coffee taster, and coffee importer from countries all over the world, is also an artist and an art teacher at NMSA here in Santa Fe, New Mexico. As you'll hear in the interview, there have been a couple miracles in Chase's life. One, I think, pertains to those people that are in our lives who become mentors, who change the course of our lives with something they say. Maybe we don't take it in at the moment that they say it, but maybe a few years down the road, those words come back. They come back to us and they change the direction of our life. Chase is in the same position now as a teacher at his school. And this interview has me wondering just what he's saying to those kids, his students, that will affect their lives in the coming years. He also tells some wonderful tales of his coffee adventures and travels, some of which include miracles as well. So now, without further ado, episode 80 of Bite-Sized Blessings.
We have the hostel guide, the guy that's running the hostel. He talks on the phone. And he says, okay, she's going to come here and pick you up in a taxi in 10 minutes. And she's going to take you to a bus stop where she's going to buy you tickets to the farm. Right before we get out of the taxi, though, right before we get on the bus, she says, you're going to go up to this kind of gas station, restaurant, convenience store in the middle of nowhere, Oaxaca, called El Mirador. It's called El Mirador. This is the Wi-Fi password. We write down the Wi-Fi password. You get on the Wi-Fi and you're going to text Alejandro, my son, and Alejandro is going to come pick you up. So Dylan puts in the phone number and I put in the phone number into our WhatsApp. So we both have the number, but in WhatsApp, the number is format. And there's a format. As soon as you put in the number, it formats to its proper formatting, but the number is not formatting at all. So I look at her and in Spanish, I say something like, you know, I don't think the number is correct. Can you repeat it? And she repeats the number and Dylan goes, no, it's correct. I'm looking at his phone and my phone and the format's wrong. And I was like, it's not the right number. We're about to drive 6 hours into the middle of the jungle and we have the wrong number. And I'm like, Dylan, please believe this is not. And so he asks again, she goes, no, yeah, that's correct. And he's like, see? And I was like, we're screwed. This is it. I'm going to be eaten by a panther or something. So in terms of a profession and what I do, I'm a coffee professional, professional taster, and a professional roaster, professional barista. And I am an artist and an arts instructor. And I make video art and sculpture.
And I think you are continually in conversation with people all over the world about coffee.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That part's probably the most interesting, fun part for me, as the idea of networking and being involved with so many different people and so many different perspectives.
And I also think you've actually traveled to different countries to meet the coffee suppliers. Is that true?
Yeah. So we've been to different farms. We've sent people to Colombia, Costa Rica, but then I've traveled other places on my own with other things for other reasons as well that also ended up being something coffee. I don't think I can travel without it being somehow pointed back toward coffee for me, which is either really, really awesome or really, really sad sometimes. Like, what if I went on vacation and didn't do anything coffee? It's impossible.
Okay, so did you grow up in a religious household? What did that look like in Texas while you were tipping cows?
I didn't grow up in a religious household. I did grow up in a religious family. My immediate sisters, Jordan at least, I was very religious. My parents weren't. They tried, you know, like there were some Christmases. I remember my dad reading the Bible to us. you know, my grandmother was very religious. We would go and we would bake Jesus-shaped cookies and things like that. You know, Easter was really big for us. We would always dress up. We'd participate in all of the events. But my parents really kind of gave us the autonomy to move forward with religion or hang back from it. But the community I was involved in small town Texas, and I live in a very small town now, Santa Fe. It's 90,000 people now, or 95,000 people, or something like that. I forget, 87,000. Live in a small town now, and I'm a high school arts teacher. When I talk to those kids about their graduating class, I tell them that, oh, I graduated a really small class, about 250 students, and their graduating class is like 100. And so they're smaller, almost by a third, right? So they're like, that's not small, that's huge. I'm like, well, I'm from Texas. Everything's huge in Texas. So 250 students is very tiny. That entire community was very, very religious. It was very, very apparent. Big part of my life for over a decade.
Did you ever feel, or did your family ever feel, any sort of pressure from the community because you didn't attend church regularly or you weren't part of that extended community there?
I can't really speak to my parents' experience on it because they're so good at hiding everything. But I definitely felt it. You know, I felt like when I had a car and I had the autonomy to move through the whatever I needed to move through the city, go anywhere I could go, I didn't really have as much excuses for my friends as to why I wasn't going to church. Before I was like, oh, my parents probably won't take me, or like, you know, they'll probably be sleeping or something. And then when I had a car, I was like, oh no, like, now I gotta go to church so I could show up and be liked in the community. It was a really rough time because being religious in that community was the social scene. You had to be religious or else you were a major outcast. And I was already outcast enough. I think my nickname in high school was Tall and Awkward. And so I didn't have much going for me there. So I had to be religious in that way so I could make sure that people would be nice to me and like me.
Well, you're still tall, but you're no longer awkward, just so you know.
I might be tall for Santa Fe. It was the shortest of all my friends, second to shortest.
Were you really? Mm-hmm. So it's like everything in Texas is big, even the kids.
Yeah, the kids are. Texas is building little super soldiers at my school. We're all, I didn't really realize this. This is where a lot of my confidence issues came into play. When I was in high school, I had zero confidence. None at all. I remember my art teacher, Bryce McCaslin, at one point, I didn't really realize what I was doing, but I think I was trying to get Bryce to make my art for me so that way it would be good. And I don't think I really realized I was doing that probably until, like, you know, sometime in college. But I remember we were leaving for break and I look at Bryce and we have this big project due. This is advanced placement art and it's really rigorous, nerve-wracking. I'd be sitting at a dining room table that was covered in a tarp to protect my mom's expensive table from all the art making. It'd be 3 a.m. before class and I'd be crying and drawing. And Bryce, I remember right before break, I came up to Bryce and I was like trying to figure out what I was going to do for this project because I didn't know, because I thought the canvas or the substrate was the most perfect it would ever be before I actually touched it. So once I touched it, it would fall apart. It'd be ruined. And I remember looking at Bryce and thinking, I don't know what to do. I don't know. And he just, you know, out of fatherly frustration in a way, it was just like, you gotta get some sort of confidence. I can't do that for you. You gotta find the confidence. You can't, I'm not there to make it. I'm not there to hold your hand through everything. Like, I'm not going to be around forever. So you're either going to do it on your own or you're not. That's where we're at. And that conversation was really hard. I think I cried probably, cause I'm a big crier, but, it really started to transform things. It planted the seed that I could do something. It didn't change anything that year. It didn't change anything for quite a while. I don't think it changed anything until I got to college. I was in a town where I was completely alone and I was out of all the social scenes that I've ever been in, realizing that I don't have Bryce McCaslin to help me. I don't have my mom to lay me down when I'm sick and give me medicines. I don't have my mom to figure out where the laundromat is for me or put away my shoes. I had to learn how to be on my own, and I was totally on my own. I was the worst, kind of the best worst moment of my life. I think the best realization I ever had, for sure. And college and moving away was one of the best things that ever happened to me. I had that epiphany that I wasn't able to play video games for the rest of my life. And I needed to do something. My parents wanted me to do something. They always pushed me toward graphic design. And then I didn't really have a direction. I really wanted to be good at something because all my friends were really good at something. And I just kind of wasn't, other than the video games. I just wasn't really good at anything. And I started doing art and I started making good art. And it wasn't conventionally good art. It wasn't photorealistic faces, which I still at that time, even though I was making really good work, still at that time I thought, oh, like I'll be a good artist when I can draw a face really well.
Oh, okay.
Or something photorealistic. And when I got to college, I was dating this girl who's incredible, and we were supposed to get married. Well, I thought we were supposed to get married, but I think she did too. We talked about it all the time. So I was supposed to move back home from Dallas, and we were supposed to get married. And when I got to school, in art school at Santa Fe University of Art and Design, I had this epiphany of like, oh crap, if I'm not great, if I'm not the best, then I'm not going to be able to do anything or provide for the people I want to provide for. So I have to be the best. Like I have to get it in gear. I can't skate by like I did in high school about everything. I just have to be the best. So I put all that pressure on myself to be the best artist possible. And I made my first photorealistic drawing of the Santa Fe ski basin. It was graphite and charcoal, and it looked like a black and white photo. And it took me weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks and tiny, tiny tons of effort. And I put on the wall at this big show that we have at the end of every semester. And we all took a step back and we looked at it. And I was like, wow, I never want to do that again. I hated it. The most important thing about being an artist, and I will say I'm an artist. I used to think it was not really deserved, but I think confidently I can say I'm an artist. The most important thing that you do as an artist, I preach this to my kids all the time, is that people think it's just about the pretty picture or the drawing, but it's all about problem solving. I think that's what I love about coffee too. I mean, coffee is such big uncharted territory. And like I mentioned earlier, United States, specifically Americans, don't really have a care about the product the way I have a care for it, which is fine. It's not their problem. But I'm able to continue in this field of art and this field of coffee because there's so many problems that need to be solved. And it's interesting and it's fun and it hasn't stopped. It's not stagnant. I love this quote by Barack Obama that he said something like, running the country is a lot like steering a ship. And if you just take the ship immediately in the direction you want to go, it capsizes. So you have to slowly over time point the ship direction. So I think about looking at the person that I was 10 years ago, 15 years ago, 2 years ago, 3 years ago. And sometimes it doesn't really feel like a whole lot's changed, but it is that, and especially from the outside looking in, you know, people probably see more about me than I see about myself. Sometimes you're too close to know what's actually happening, but I feel like all my experiences have always been something that I took in to make changes through the way I move through life. I remember creating these analogies for myself when I'd make work, which would then help me create analogies myself on how I would go out and operate in the world. I had this professor one time say, we're doing figure drawing, and she wants to draw the entire space. It wasn't just about the figure, because the figure exists in the space. So she had us walk in a circle around the room and around the model. And we we had to walk in this big circle and we had to, you know, kind of put our hands on things. And as we're moving, she said, I want you to imagine that the entire room is filled with oatmeal. And that as you get closer, that oatmeal is kind of pushing up against other objects. And you can actually physically feel the space all of a sudden between the interstitial spaces. You can feel them between. So we're doing that. We're walking in circles. And, you know, some people are like, this is hokey and weird. And I'm sitting there soaking it up. But through that ability to create analogies or to think of the world in a different way, and maybe it roots back to the problem solving. Prior to going to this Panama, Mexico, Guatemala trip, I thought I'd had some pretty major memory loss issues. And I started to, I couldn't remember, you know, a lot of us talk about this. So this isn't like too shocking for people. I couldn't remember what I ate for breakfast and was like, oh yeah, you know, let's just wait. But I couldn't remember what had been said to me seconds ago, tasks. I couldn't hold on to anything in my brain. So we're in Mexico and we're having this cup of coffee from Finca Chelín. And as I was saying, it was tasting really borderline effervescent, as if it had been carbonated, kind of like a white wine and like a floral red fruit. And I really loved it. And turns out it was a carbonic coffee. And Finca Chelín, he's a fermentation expert, and he taught adding yeasts and different fermentation methods to the coffees to farmers in Chiapas for years. And him and his son broke off and did their own farm in Oaxaca. So we're hearing about this farm and I was like, this is the farm we want to go to. We got to be there. So Dylan books a flight to Oaxaca. The next 40 minutes, we're sitting on a plane from Mexico City getting to Oaxaca. And we make it, we're trying to figure out how we're going to get to the farm, how we're going to get to the farm. And we're looking around and remember, we don't know anybody. We don't have any connections. We get a connection to a girl named Kate, and Kate and I have a different connection today, but we've never actually talked or met because we couldn't find Kate. We just misconnect the entire time. And Kate has an amazing roastery and cafe in Oaxaca, Cintro. If you ever go, you can find Kate's roastery. I don't remember the name because never got connected, but we, get there and we misconnect with Kate. And we wake up the next morning and Dylan is frantic. Dylan, well, not super frantic, but he's a little upset. He's like, we're here on a job. We have a mission and we're kind of failing and we can't fail. We can't show up empty handed. We need to prove that this travel program is worthwhile to our boss. So he continues to create a travel program to send baristas to buy coffee. So we sit there. And I have this stroke of brilliance. I'm like, we could Google it. So I just search on Google Finca Chelín, and it shows up with a cafe, you know, across the other side of Oaxaca Centro. So 5-6 blocks away, where it was a hotel, and Finca Chelín had their coffee at this hotel in bags, and that's where they sold it. So we went over to the hotel and we sit down. We're having this really bad cup of coffee. It's just made out of like a Mr. Coffee. So it's really watered down, just tastes like paper. And we're sitting there drinking this coffee and we talk to the hostess and we're like, do you know how to get in touch with this farmer? And she's like, no. We're like, oh crap. And he's like, but his wife is going to be here in about an hour dropping off the coffee. And I was like, okay, you do know how. Okay. So we kind of walk around for a little bit. We make it back. His wife had already left. So we start to panic and she's like, but don't worry. I got her number and she wants you to call her. And so I'm kind of with the hostess, like, what's with all this push and pull? Like, no, I don't know how to get in touch. She's gone. But we can get this all sorted out. So we get in touch with the farmer's wife. Dylan had been in a Spanish intensive and spoke better Spanish than me. But in Dylan's words, he has to close his eyes and he'd turn all the lights off and no one can be moving in the room. And he could speak Spanish really well. But so we have the hostel guide, the guy that's running the hostel. He talks on the phone and he says, okay, she's going to come here and pick you up in a taxi in 10 minutes. And she's going to take you to a bus stop where she's going to buy you tickets to the farm. So now we're on this bus. Right before we get out of the taxi, though, right before we get on the bus, she says, you're going to go up to this kind of gas station restaurant convenience store in the middle of nowhere, Oaxaca, called El Mirador. This is in Luxacha. It's called El Mirador. This is the Wi-Fi password. We write down the Wi-Fi password. You get on the Wi-Fi and you're going to text Alejandro, my son, and Alejandro is going to come pick you up. So Dylan puts in the phone number and I put in the phone number into our WhatsApp. So we both have the number. But in WhatsApp, the number is format, and there's a format. As soon as you put in the number, it formats to its proper formatting, but the number is not formatting at all. So I look at her and in Spanish, I say something like, you know, I don't think the number is correct. Can you repeat it? And she repeats the number and Dylan goes, no, it's correct. I'm looking at his phone and my phone and the format's wrong. And I was like, it's not the right number. We're about to drive 6 hours into the middle of the jungle and we have the wrong number. And I'm like, Dylan, please believe this is not. And so he asks again, she goes, no, yeah, that's correct. And he's like, see? And I was like, we're screwed. This is it. I'm going to be eaten by a panther or something. This is it. So we make our way up this mountain and we're in this kind of small, charter bus. It's like a quarter size bus. And they're playing some delisted movie that stars Meatloaf, the lead singer of Meatloaf, as the antagonist. I think it's Patrick Swayze or somebody. And it's essentially just a bunch of trucks that are driving into each other and exploding, and they're transporting illegal weapons. But Patrick Swayze, if it was Patrick Swayze, I don't remember. Patrick Swayze had no idea that he was transporting illegal weapons, and he's gotten out of this life, but they pulled him back in type moment. So I'm sitting there and we're driving through this really thick fog on these tiny roads, and we're swerving out of the way of rocks and cars. And I'm sitting there watching these trucks like driving off cliffs and exploding. And I was like, this is probably my fate. And I'm starting to get a little car sick. Just like, and the movie is obnoxiously loud. It was one of the most loud. It didn't need to be that loud. There's three of us in the car, in the bus. So we finally make it up to El Mirador, and it's golden hour on the side of a giant mountain in Oaxaca. And the sunset is absolutely gorgeous. We're standing in a forest, looking out over tons of mountains. And we type in the Wi-Fi password. And Dylan's like, okay, now it's time to text Alejandro. And I'm sitting there going, well, at least I have a sleeping bag. So Dylan goes to text and Dylan goes, huh, the number is not right. And I was like, no freaking way. Like, oh my gosh, so upset. And so Dylan is like, oh no, what do we do? And I just sat there and in a different language, I had to recall and piece together this number back. And I realized that they had added a one in the middle of the phone number, and that one needed to be moved to the beginning. And I somehow put it together and the number formatted correctly. And then at this point, you're thinking like, well, God, I hope this is Alejandro. And so we text Alejandro. 3 minutes, 4 minutes go by, 5 minutes go by. I'm sitting there sweating, like we're sleeping and we're camping tonight. And Alejandro texts back. He says, oh yeah, on my way. Be there in 5 minutes. And we make it to Finca Chalín and we get to stay at the farmer's house there and have some of the most incredible Mexican coffee that I've ever had in my life. But the kind of the point of that story is this actually got my teaching job. That story got me the teaching job at NMSA here in Santa Fe. The point of the story was the artist's brain, the idea of problem solving. I think a lot of the times we arrive at something that's really difficult in our life and you're confronted with dealing with it or shying away. And a lot of us don't really realize what we're capable of doing. So being an artist, I would run into problems all the time that nobody's ever solved because no one's ever thought to create what I'm creating. So there's really not a whole lot of solutions to find on Google or to read in a book. You have to work through it. And I think that was one of those moments where it was kind of sink or swim. And we swam and it was great.
You swam. Dylan was over there like slightly drowning and you pulled him out. I mean, I guess part of the miracle is making it work because I would be terrified. I would seriously be terrified.
So, I think I, in terms of solving problems, I talk a lot about this idea that I refer to as fixed parameters. And when you're operating, you move through life with a bunch of fixed parameters. There's things that you can't change. So for instance, in the roasting world, there's a lot of roasters, and you can look this up, that try to capitalize on the idea of high altitude roasting. Iconic is one of the highest altitude roasters in the nation. I think we're like one of 10, and we're definitely up there at 7,100 feet above sea level. And they all sell this high altitude roasting as some sort of gimmicky positive. Whereas I can never see why it would ever be positive. It makes no sense. In fact, I would probably argue that it's more negative. But even if it is negative or positive, when people ask me about this situation, like, oh, what are the challenges? What are the benefits? My answer is just, it's neither or. It's just something that we work with. And I never think about it anymore because it's something I can't change. And if I can't change it, it's not really worth my time and energy to figure out what it is about it that makes it inherently it. I don't know why it's analogous to that previous story, but maybe it just comes along with trying to be understanding of people. I probably could have lost my mind at Dylan and been like, you're going to kill us if we don't get the right number, but keeping calm and kind of working through it and knowing that Dylan is his own fixed parameter. I love Dylan, by the way.
Tell me like one of the funniest stories of that you've had traveling in another country with coffee that has to do with coffee.
Yeah. So we're in Guatemala for the first time. This is 2016, and we're in Guatemala with, it's an iconic crew. There's Rachel and Morgan, and then there's Sean and myself. We're at the end of our trip. Sean is really trying to budget everything out and teach us that we can go to these other countries and live off of essentially nothing. So we're staying in these hostels, and Rachel, who's a woman of a certain age, and Morgan, who's about my age, Rachel did not want to stay in the hostels at all. She's lived her life. She's done. She doesn't want to do these crappy hostels. So she's getting hotel rooms. Every single time we'd pass by these beautiful hotels, I'd be like, oh, Rachel, look at this hostel. And trying to be like, no, that is not a hostel. Stop. Toward the end of the trip, Sean finagled this beautiful hotel room because they didn't want to stay in a hostel. Sean went in and finagled a 2-bedroom spot for the price of 2 people, and all 4 of us stayed. So Rachel and Morgan had a bed, Sean and I had a bed, and it's in a smaller room. It's not like everyone had their own room. It's a pretty typical hotel, but when you walk in, it had like this accordion style door that was the toilet, and you kind of had a large vanity for like a sink and mirrors. And then the bed was immediately next to the vanity, little coffee table or bedstand table, and then the other bed. So Sean and I are in one bed and Rachel and Morgan, the other bed. And I am a really polite sleeper and a light sleeper. If someone else is in the bed next to me, I am trying not to move all night. I'm trying to stay very still so I don't wake them up. So I'm at the very edge of the bed sleeping, and I feel like I'm like, so I wake up and I feel like I'm aggravating Sean. So I like slowly move over to the edge where I'm almost falling off the bed. I move over to the edge to make sure Sean's comfortable. And all of a sudden, Sean just starts like violently kicking and freaking out. And he's just kicking and kicking. And I'm like, oh no, I've irritated him somehow. And so I slowly, like the kicking just stops. And I quietly and slowly like turn over to see what was happening. And Sean is sitting straight up in the bed, staring out into pitch black nothingness and just sitting there staring. And my heart just starts pounding. I was like, this is it. He's lost it. He's going to kill us all. And so I like immediately turn over and I'm sitting there and I'm like, okay, just go to sleep. So Sean probably gets up. We didn't let Sean shave the entire trip. He had this massive beard. We weren't slapping a razor out of his hand, but we were like, you can't do that. So Sean gets up about 3 in the morning, turns on the vanity, which is right in the room, and shaves his entire beard, 3 a.m. And I, you know, it's Sean. So I roll my eyes, I roll over. Sean's also a fixed parameter. I roll my eyes, I roll over. And morning comes about 8 a.m. And that classic thing of like everybody at the sleepover wakes up at the same time. And so Morgan, Rachel, and I are in the room. Rachel looks at me and she's like, "Where's Sean?" I said, "I don't know. He left at 3 a.m. in Guatemala, in Atitlan, Guatemala, or sorry, in Antigua, Guatemala. He left at 3 a.m. Where's he going? No idea." So she was like, "Did he shave his beard?" And I was like, "Yeah, he did. It was really rude. We're all trying to sleep." And she was like, "So rude." And right at that moment, Sean opens the door, full beard. And Rachel and I look at each other. We look at Sean. I was like, "What? I thought you shaved your beard." And he goes, "No, but did you feel that earthquake last night?" And I was like, "Oh my God." So Sean wasn't kicking. There was this massive earthquake. A volcano had erupted and it set off this massive earthquake. And I turned over to find Sean staring out into the darkness. Sean was counting the seconds to feel for another earthquake, because at that point, had he felt it, he would have woken us up and made us jump off the balcony into the pool below. To which I said, "Rachel wouldn't have made that." And he goes, "Not everyone always makes the chase." So, oh gosh.
Thank you for listening to episode 80 of Bite-Sized Blessings. I need to thank my wonderful and hilarious guest, Chase Stafford, for sharing all the stories of his travels, his adventures. I'm very grateful he didn't end up having to jump off that balcony into the pool below. I need to thank the creators of the music used as well, John Bartman, Taiga Sound Production, Chilled Music, and Frank Schroeder. For complete attribution, please see the Bite-Sized Blessings website at bitesizedblessings.com. On the website, you'll find links to other artists, musicians, changemakers, and books I hope will lighten and brighten your day. Thank you for listening, and here's my one request. Rate and review the podcast. No, seriously, go ahead. Ratings and reviews help other people find us. But I'm just kidding. That's not my only request. I have another one as well. Be like Chase. Cultivate an artist's mind. Try to see the world in all its permutations from every single angle. And maybe one of those angles will help you solve a problem when you absolutely need it to.